Most experts believe that within 30 to 40 years, the world's oil supply will begin to dry up. Already by 2010, which is only 5 years away, the Muslim world will control as much as 60% of the world's oil production. And even more importantly, no less than 95% of the remaining global oil export capacity. By contrast, the United States, which in 1990 produced domestically nearly three-fifths of its total energy demand, is predicted to produce less than two-fifths by 2010. That's what this war was all about, because Iraq is the second largest supplier of oil in the world after Saudi Arabia. But what is so utterly, utterly tragic, in my view, about this war is not just that it was unprovoked, not just that it was illegal, not just that it was promulgated on the basis of lies and deception and has turned into a charnel house of bloodletting of innocent lives. It is also, and I think it is almost unbearable to have to face up to this, it is utterly futile. Because even if Iraq were pacified, even if the Iraqi oil supplies were secure, it would extend the availability of global oil supplies by at most some 5 years. And at that point, just marginally later, the world will still have to wean itself off its addiction to oil, because the oil just isn't there anymore.
You're listening to the Citizens Tribunal on Iraq, held September 19th in Binghamton, New York, in conjunction with a federal trial of Danny Burns, Peter DeMott, Claire Grady, and Teresa Grady, the St. Patrick's Four. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. We continue with the Citizen Tribunal on Iraq.
And that's why the St. Patrick's Four were right to take a stand that says no to militarism, no to occupation of other nations' territory, and no to lying as a way of government. I salute the St. Patrick's Four.
Michael Meacher, Member of Parliament, former Minister of the Environment in the Blair government.
And I simply conclude by saying this. I believe that they should not be on trial at all. They should be being rewarded with the highest accolades for their adherence to truth and justice and honesty.
Okay, now we'll have a period of questions and very brief commentaries. This young man right here, stand and speak forcefully for 2 minutes.
In February of 2003, they say approximately 35 million people worldwide demonstrated, I think for the first time in advance, of a war that most of us knew was going to transpire. Why would it make any difference if 35 million people were to march on Washington on September the 24th? Wouldn't it be again dismissed as a focus group?
Okay. Who would like to take that question?
I will. Well, I think it's really important. I mean, we can sit around in our little hometowns like sheep, and the administration knows for sure that nobody cares, or we can go to Washington and we can stand there as a big group, and they'll know that some care. Now, whether or not it really forces a change in policy, that's kind of up to us. And probably the first time that we can really put pressure is on these upcoming congressional elections. Elections that ought to, in my opinion, this one time, it should be a one-issue campaign. Whether or not somebody's willing to stop the war. And if they aren't willing, then screw the pork barrel for your district. You don't need it. We need the end to the war. And if you're going to keep electing people that are going to keep war going on, we're getting what we deserve. So we got to stand up in these elections. And we've all got to start running for office, too. I mean, we need to have some real clear decisions, clear differences, so that we can have these choices. And I hope for all of you all, the choice is whether we are at war or whether we are at peace, and make it a one-issue campaign.
The difference between the past and the present is 35 million or whatever that demonstrates in Washington will be part of the majoritarian mainstream of the United States now in comparison with the past. Remember, when the first march took place, Bush had the backing of 70 or 80%. Now we have 53% against the war. So we are resonating with the majority of the American people. We are resonating at a time when the president is at his lowest point in popularity for the horrendous crime of Katrina and other such foibles. So we are now in the most important point of engaging the president. Next question.
My anger just isn't with what's happening in the White House. My anger is also to Congress. How dare they abrogate their constitutional duty in terms of declaring war? So I think that we need to hold our Congress people accountable. A question is, do they have access to the CIA intelligence reports? Why were they duped? I knew Bush was lying. I knew the administration was lying. I read the PNAC report. Why didn't they know? I'm also concerned about the fate of the disappeared. We are having them in this country. And the current candidate for Supreme Court Justice, the Chief Justice, handed down a decision that makes it legal for the president to declare anyone an enemy combatant to go to jail without charges or legal assistance. We are setting it up for many disappeared, more than what's in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and all the places that we already have many people who have disappeared. We've got to do something about that as well.
Well, I think the most important question that needs an answer is why our elected representatives, save Maurice Hinchley, who why were they duped, or why did they let themselves be duped? Remember, back in 2002, after the decision for war, when they got together in that putative meeting that I was describing, Karl Rove was also there. They were concerned not only to get this war underway with the approval of Congress, if possible, not only because it gets hot in Iraq during the summer, somebody told them that, okay, but also because there were midterm elections in November. And many Democrats had no backbone whatsoever, because they looked back at 1991 and they saw that those Democrats who voted against the first Gulf War took it on the chin. And so Karl Rove orchestrated the whole thing so that the vote would come after the president on October 7th said, "Mushroom cloud, if we don't do something about Saddam Hussein." Condoleezza Rice, October 8th, "Mushroom cloud." Victoria Clark from the Ministry of Defense, "Mushroom cloud." And on October 10th and 11th, your representatives and mine, your senators and mine, voted to approve this war. Now, why John Kerry? Why John Kerry could not have said last year, "Yeah, I voted for the war, Because you lied to me, Mr. President, because you told a whole pile of lies. That's why I voted for this war. Why he could not have said that is just beyond me. And what we need are people with much more backbone, much more integrity that can say, look, this is wrong. I voted against it because you lied to me. I would not vote against it now. We're going to end it now, and we're going to end it soon, now.
I'm here. My name is Robbie Sinnott, and I'm here representing, I'm here representing five other Plowshare activists who disarmed a U.S. Navy plane in Shannon Airport in February 2003. Okay, unfortunately, they cannot be here themselves because they're preparing for their own retrial on the 24th of October. And they would love to be here to show their solidarity, but it is just not possible. They're feeling quite isolated at the moment. We in Ireland are very proud of our neutrality. Our government has completely overridden the wishes of the Irish people. 100,000 people took to the streets of Dublin calling for an end to US use of a civilian airport, Shannon Airport. 158,000 US troops have passed through Shannon Airport since January the 1st this year, through this neutral country. Our government pays 3 million euro, $5 million per year for this privilege. Our government pays the US landing fees. There are many direct actions throughout the world and many whistleblowers. People in Ireland are quite aware that this is going on. Unfortunately, there are so many issues of corruption with our government, foreign policy doesn't get a look in. But this is all part of the neocon agenda. But back to the Plowshares action that was done, they're trying to revive the media interest in Ireland and throughout the world in the action that they took. They stayed and they prayed on the job. They waited to be arrested, and they comforted the people who arrested them because they were afraid they'd lose their jobs because they got in so easily. Okay, the first trial that was barred, the judge admitted that he was prejudiced. I suspect he couldn't wait for his place on the Supreme Court in Ireland, and he was too eager. Okay, the next trial, it says in criminal damage in Irish law that if you have a lawful excuse, if you believe that property will be used to kill people, or that property will be used even to destroy other property, you can damage. So the only way they can be found guilty is through a corrupt Irish judiciary, and I don't think that's beyond the bounds of possibility. Because we are not, it's not a case of Ireland or America. We have the same global people to oppose here. We've got the same, it's not a question of what country you're in. This is a global operation. And people in Austria and England, there's been many direct actions against air bases in Britain too, and in Australia, and all over the world, people are turning and they know that direct action is the way to go because they are afraid of direct action.
Thank you.
It's also, just finally, as I say, not everybody can do a direct action, but what people can do, which is just as important, is solidarity. Because solidarity will give strength to the people who do direct actions, and this is extremely vital.
Thank you very much. Okay, Ray's ready to answer you.
Thank you for the questions. On the CIA, I've written two chapters and two books on this. I'd refer you to them. One was a book produced by the Eisenhower Foundation. The chapter is a Compromised CIA, What Can Be Done? And then a book just out this week called Neocon Again. The title of the chapter is Sham Dunk, Cooking Intelligence for the President. In a word, this corruption of the CIA is something that has matured over 24 years. It goes back to Bill Casey, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan. It's a systemic problem now because the people who were moved up to higher positions were moved up on the basis of how smartly they could salute the agenda in the White House. This grieves me deeply because it prostitutes the whole process and it makes worthless the advice given to the president, but the president seems oblivious to this at present. There's one good point, and that is simply this, and I think it may be significant. Iran is the big issue now, right? And we have the vice president, and we have even the president saying that we can't tolerate an Iran with a nuclear capability, and everyone's warning, that is Cheney, that the Iranians could have a nuclear weapon, you know, imminently, and so we have to do something about it, or maybe the Israelis have to do something about it. Well, folks, the CIA and the other intelligence analysts have put their pen to paper on this, and their conclusion is that it's 10 years away, that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon for 10 years. Now, what does that mean? That means that somebody's told it like it is, like we used to do in the old days. Somebody told an honest story, number one. And then five, we call them patriotic truth tellers. They're more pejoratively referred to as leakers. Five leakers gave that story to the Washington Post. Wonder of wonders, a reporter at the Washington Post thought it interesting enough to write up, and I guess it was Summer Help that was on that day, but it appeared as the lead item on the front page. So those are four extraordinary miracles which give me some hope that even the mainstream press may be catching on. With respect to Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame, I'll just say a couple of things. Number one, Patrick Fitzpatrick, maybe I'm a little chauvinistic here because he's Irish. I know where he comes from. He grew up in New York. He was educated by the Jesuits like me. I have a lot of hope that he's going to come up with something very, very interesting within the next month or two. He may be fired before he does that, and that's quite possible. But if he's fired, I think we all march down to Washington the next day and raise a hue and cry. So I think that's another positive, and the administration will be feeling the pressure on that. The other thing I'd say is that in all this, who told what to whom? Those are the trees that you lose sight of the forest. Where did this all start? It all started with a forgery, folks. It all started with a forged document that said Iraq was seeking uranium in Niger. Who did the forgery? Who did the forgery? Now, when Senator Rockefeller, a ranking member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, tried to persuade Senator Pat Roberts, the Republican chair, let's ask the FBI to look into that. Roberts said, no, that would be inappropriate. That would be inappropriate. Suffice it to say, folks, that it is my considered judgment that that forgery was an inside job. Not only was our president and the rest of this administration relying on the spurious information to persuade our Congress to declare war, but they actually had the information concocted themselves. Listen, remember where you heard this first, because I think in the next few weeks we'll know which of the retired alumni of my organization who hire themselves out to do such things were guilty of perpetrating this heinous act, which was seized upon our vice president as proof that Iraq had reconstituted, as he said, their nuclear weapons program. So don't forget that this Sam Wilson, Valerie Plame, Patrick Fitzgerald, the whole business goes back to the forgery, okay? And the forgery, somebody did it. And it's really very strange to me that nobody's been able to figure out who did it. But I think Fitzgerald and others may be working on that. I think we'll see the answer to that very soon.
This question is for Raymond. Raymond, did the CIA have any advanced direct knowledge that there were no weapons in Iraq before we invaded back on March 19th, 2003?
The CIA had information such as that described by Michael Meacher here. There was a discrepancy, an accounting discrepancy between the number of weapons of mass destruction destroyed, known to have been destroyed, and the number that was on some books earlier on. The analysis was shoddy at best. It was contrived to fit in with what Vice President Cheney has said on August 26th of 2002, namely that the Iraqis had reconstituted or were reconstituting their nuclear program. To its great credit, the State Department would not go along with that. They said that, look, the big question was how soon could Iraq have a nuclear capability, and they refused to say. And it was really bizarre because they said in very diplomatic language, they said, we don't think the program has begun or has been restarted, and so it's really unfair to ask us to predict when it will end, you know? It sort of reminded me of that wonderful cartoon my middle daughter sent me from the University of Virginia where she was majoring in history. It was a BC cartoon, you know, and the father's up there with his loincloth on. He's standing on a rock, and his daughter, the student, was cringing before him, and he had two tablets, and obviously they were a report card, and the caption said, oh, great, history, F, you flunked something, didn't even happen yet. So the State Department was being asked to predict the end of a program that didn't even happen yet, okay?
I have three questions. My first question has to do with immigrant and racial profiling, both in the UK and the US, as it relates to anti-terrorism legislation. My second question has to do with the environment, and the third one has to do with the local media. So the first question I want to ask has to do, I mean, we just started having bag searches in Manhattan. I'm not from there, but I worked there this summer. And I know that in the UK, you've had bag searches for quite some time now. And according to the police reports in the UK, if you were Southeast Asian or Asian, you were three times as likely as a white man to be searched. But if you were a black man, you were eight times as likely to be searched. So I'm worried about, like, in the United States right now, we have institutions like ICE and Homeland Security using anti-terrorist legislation to basically trick immigrant workers into getting deported out of the United States. I know in North Carolina, they basically said they were having an OSHA meeting. All workers had to report, and in fact, it was ICE from Homeland Security, and they all got deported to their countries. So how do we address that? My second question, you know, in terms of weaning the United States and the rest of the country off of oil, I know that the UK has made commitments basically weaning themselves off of creating CO2 gases and greenhouse gases. I want to know, you know, how much of it really has to do with our individual consumption patterns and how much does it have to do with industries and institutions being changed, big guys versus the little guys. And then my third question is just for the people out here. It's just a logistical question. Is anybody here from the Binghamton University pipe dream? Because I'm very concerned because I have repeatedly informed the editors at our local school that this is going on, and they haven't written anything about it. And I think that there's a certain pettiness and hostility towards activism in this community and social justice. So if everybody, when you go home tonight, please write an email to editor@bupipedream.com. That's editor@bupipedream.com, because one of the reasons why there are almost no students here is because certain petty people are not covering the news. It's not just they're copying the corporate media, and they think that that's what works. So if everybody here wrote an email and shamed the pipe dream into writing about this, I think it's really important. Thank you.
Yeah. One of them was the whole question of weaning our countries off oil. I think the UK is not ahead of you. I think there is still, as we saw a comment made by Gordon Brown, the Chancellor of Exchequer at the weekend when oil prices hit $65, $67 a barrel, and when the price was 90p, nearly £1 per litre in the UK, which is twice the level which is already regarded as exceedingly high in this country. And he was saying that the OPEC countries, Saudi, etc., has got to increase their production in order to ease the pressures and to bring down the price. Well, that, of course, is the opposite of actually what ought to be done. What we should be doing is using the crisis of these very high prices to say that we simply cannot go on like this, that the demand (clears throat) The demand for oil from China, from India, other countries, which are colossal in size, 2 out of every 5 human beings on this planet are Chinese or Indians, and they now have growth rates of 7 or 10% a year. And so their demand for oil is absolutely enormous. It's not about crises which are happening necessarily in the Middle East or wars or even, dare I say it, Katrina. It is actually about the sheer, remorseless, relentless pressure for oil from these enormous economies which are growing so fast. So I don't think we have learnt the lesson. There are pressures in the UK from the lorry drivers that they're going to besiege the refineries in order to try and bring the economy to a halt and force the government to lower the tax. Most of us think, again, that would be a disastrous thing to do because it merely forestalls the point at which we have to face the fact that we have got fundamentally to change. But that means shifting to renewable sources of energy. And it means... I mean, gas is certainly going to be a transitional energy source. There's no doubt about that. But we have got to shift to wind, to solar, to biomass, to tidal power. And I read the other day, I mean, you will know better than me whether it's true, that North and South Dakota and Texas have enough wind capacity to provide the whole of the United States with its electricity generation that is required. I mean, in other words, the potential is there. It is our governments, and it's always governments who are the very last to get the message, who hang on grimly in the thrall of the vested interests, who are not prepared to make the change. But we have got to make the change. It's going to be painful, but it becomes more and more painful the more that decision is left.
I have a question for the British gentleman. You very clearly identified this war as a war for oil. Not only that, but you also made it very clear that even if the Iraqi oil is secured by American forces, it is going to last only a few years. So my conclusion is this war is not going to stop in Iraq. Who's next? Is Venezuela next? Is Chavez, Big Mouth, and friendship with Fidel a good enough excuse to put Venezuela in line for an invasion by US and UK and some other allies?
Well, that's a very good question. If your policy is to stick to oil to the very last drop, I agree. It will be Iran. Of course, the issue is, at least ostensibly, it is actually about nuclear weapons. On the grounds that it's all right if the United States has nuclear weapons, if Britain has nuclear weapons, but it's not, and indeed if Israel has nuclear weapons, and Pakistan and India, etc., but not if Iran has nuclear weapons. But that's another issue. I think the logic of that is extremely difficult to understand. If all the other countries need nuclear weapons for their own protection, why is it that Iran is so very different? We want a world without nuclear weapons, but I don't see that you can have nuclear weapons and then deny it to others. But Iran, of course, has the second largest amount of oil in the world after Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has by far and away the most. Then I think it's Iran, then Iraq, and then the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, I think, are the top five. But as you say, there is Venezuela. Mr. Chavez, I think, is not very popular with this particular administration. And certainly, I think any pressure that could be put on him, partly because he's doing deals with China, as indeed Iran is. There's been a $200 billion long-term oil deal which Iran has made with China. So there is a sort of coalition of major states, oil-producing states, along with those other states like China, India, Russia, which are a sort of superpower coalition against the West, against the United States and, you know, some European countries like the UK. And I agree, if this policy, if the pressures to ensure control of the oil continue, and there is an unwillingness to draw the obvious lesson, just as President Bush seems incapable of drawing the obvious lesson about the Kyoto Protocol and climate change. You don't have to join up to the climate to the Kyoto Protocol if you don't want to, although I think you should, but you simply have got to take account of the fact that climate change is happening and that United States, which is responsible for a quarter of all emissions in the world, has got to take action in order to reduce them. But if one is not willing to face those obvious facts, which in the end the natural world will make us face, because climate change is not going to stop unless we remove the causes of it, and the demand for oil will not reduce unless we shift to an alternative energy source, then I agree with you. Any of these other countries may be targets. I think it is almost impossible to think of it. I didn't believe that we would ever attack Iraq. When it was first mooted 3 or 4 years ago, I couldn't believe it. I dismissed it as not a serious possibility, but it's happened. And now the threat is against Iran, it's against North Korea, it's against Syria. There are a number of countries which are being very seriously threatened. And I think it is absolutely incumbent on the allies of the United States, such as the UK, to use every pressure that we can bring to bear to get a change of course, because this course, which is being followed by President Bush, is simply not sustainable.
I have a brief comment and a question. When I teach my human rights class, students frequently become very demoralized after hearing about all of the horrific things that our own government has done and that other governments have done. Between what's been said tonight, particularly what Mr. McGovern said earlier, I'm sort of taking to heart the idea we may not have until the midterm elections if we don't want things to go even worse. So I guess my question to you is, what do you think it's going to take between now and the midterm elections to stop this war? Thank you.
Well, let me just say very briefly, for those of you who don't remember Vietnam, it was not our leaders in the executive or in the legislative branch. It was us. You know, my favorite theologian, Annie Dillard, has this wonderful expression. He said, "Who shall ascend to the mountain of God? Who shall stand in God's holy place? There is only us. There never has been any other." Okay? These are the times for us. That's why we should follow the example, the edifying example of the St. Patrick's Four. They spoke out early on because they were convinced and because they were convicted. They're not going to be convicted now. They were convinced. What I'm saying is that I think we need to sort of heed what Martin Luther King advised us of way back from the Birmingham City Jail, when he said that there comes a time when you have to put your body, your flesh and blood into the equation to sensitize the conscience, because it's a matter of conscience. The churches, we know, excuse the expression, but in my view, they are riding shotgun for the system. You won't hear any prophetic word from our establishment churches. And so who does that leave? It's up to us, folks. If you can't get down to Washington, come here, but do something, because time is running out. The last thing I'll say is that, the smart people tell me, well, Ray, look, what we're going to do is, they know that they're in too deep now, and what they're going to do is, in 10 months they'll say, well, okay, we did all we could for these recalcitrant Iraqis, and we'll just leave right before the midterm elections, that'll be fine. Well, I think it's equally likely. Remember, we're talking about the crazies, okay? I think it's equally likely that they'll bite up even more than they can chew. And with all these Air Force generals advising the president, look, we can make these surgical strikes or use these little nuclear weapons to get all those Iranian nuclear things out of there, I think that it's equally likely that the president would succumb to that kind of pressure, because, after all, he gets his stature from being what? A war
president, right? Okay. So that's why it's urgent, folks. That's why we have to come out in droves, and that's why we may have to do a little civil disobedience.
Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern.
One point I'd like to raise. The Vietnam War ended because there were no soldiers to fight it. The U.S. Army was totally inoperative in Vietnam. There were over 50 anti-war newspapers in Vietnam. There was massive opposition to conscription. The Bush administration is horrendously concerned about the tremendous decline in volunteers for the reserve and for reenlistment. If we can take the lesson from the St. Patrick Four, in the schools, in the churches, wherever, discouraging volunteers for the Army. You can't fight for oil, you can't fight for world domination without an army. That should be a primary concern, a massive, vocal campaign against joining the military. And I think that is what the St. Patrick's Four, that's their cardinal sin. They focus precisely on the weakest, the Achilles heel of this whole administration, because we all know the Wolfowitz, the Cheneys, the others, the Abrams, do not have their children lined up to fight in that war.
Professor James Petras.
I'd first like to remind everyone that the PNAC document, which Mr. Meacher referenced, called for a new Pearl Harbor. Given that, I submit that the biggest lie behind the Iraq War was 9/11 itself. And my real question here for Mr. McGovern is, even allowing all the nonsense that the administration has put forth and accepting all their stories, can you honestly say that 9/11 could have happened as they describe without acts of treason high in the United States government? Thank you.
I've talked to many people about this, many knowledgeable people. Colleen Rowley, the Minneapolis FBI lawyer, recently retired, who is running for Congress, by the way, in Minnesota, warns me, Ray, there's no underestimating the ability of government bureaucrats and officials to screw up. Just when you think they couldn't perform any worse, they do. Now, she comes out of the FBI, and there's certainly ample evidence to support that judgment in the FBI, but I can no longer believe that this was simply a case of gross negligence or mismanagement. There are too many unanswered questions. They are unanswered because the administration will not answer them. And I admire the people who are pursuing these theories, and I resent very much that they're labeled as conspiracy theories, because the account that's wrapped up in the 9/11 report, that is the government's conspiracy theory. That doesn't hold water. It's wrong on several counts, and they refuse to interview people who knew more. One example, very briefly. Here's the president down in Sarasota, okay? He's going in to read to the children. Everybody in the world knows where he is, okay? Andy Card comes in and says the second plane hit the next tower. And some of you have seen the film, the president just stands there. Well, the Secret Service guy says, we're out of here. Precisely the right reaction, of course, if not to protect the president, but about the school kids there? You know, everybody knows where the president is. 11 planes were listed as unaccountable at that moment by the FAA. So we're out of here. 24 minutes the president stays in this thing. Well, now, why weren't they out of there? Obviously, someone overruled the Secret Service agent. Obviously, someone knew that the president wasn't in any danger. And so they leisurely drove back to the airport, didn't request any air cover, and flew around the country for a little while, not knowing where to go. Now, how do you explain that? Well, I asked the head of the White House detail of the Secret Service under Ronald Reagan, who's a good friend of mine. How do you figure that, Jerry? How could that ever happen? And he's baffled. He says, well, Ray, maybe they needed to refuel the plane. I said, give me a break, Jerry. You know, give me a break. So there's no explanation for that. And that's just one of several things. There's no explanation, no satisfactory explanation. So my last word on this is I urge you strongly to read two books, both by David Ray Griffin. The first one is called The New Pearl Harbor, and the second one is called The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. And then form your own judgments.
Jim, one thing you left out of Vietnam was the fact that there were over 100 draft board actions in this country that destroyed the ability of the Selective Service System to draft young men, operating as it did on a shoestring budget. You've blessed anger tonight, thank you, because I am feeling angry. I have 40 years of nonviolent resistance to this government's wars under my belt. And I felt I was being told by Ann tonight how to demonstrate and how to try to turn this around. I know the movement in this country to be anarchistic. Obviously, we need to mobilize. Obviously, we need to talk about effectiveness. But don't try to use us. And don't push elections on us again. Yes, we know we've got to elect, but don't give us that out. We've been there, we've been there, we've been there, and we know we'll be there and be there and be there. We're going to Washington, and many of us will risk arrest in Washington because we can't do anything else, because our consciences demand it, not because I have any hope that that will touch George W. Bush.
Very good.
May I just make a quick response, though? I certainly appreciate and acknowledge what you're saying. What people do is entirely on their... It's what you need to do for your own conscience and what you think will make a difference. And I totally subscribe to nonviolence. I'm not a violent person, and if I happen to get arrested, it will be because of some nonviolent thing that I do. But I'm not about to go into any sort of a violent mode. And I certainly appreciate what you're saying. And everybody, I would encourage nonviolent protests to government policies. Thank you.
That's okay. Teresa. She's one of the SB4. Hi, everybody. I'm a student from Binghamton University. I just have two questions, but they're relatively quick. My first one is about Iran. The government and the media have been saying for the last God knows how many months that they want, you know, nuclear energy to build weapons, but Iran keeps saying that they want it for energy. And nobody has to answer this part, but it's just for something for us to ponder. Why is it so impossible for this country, this government, and the media to give them the benefit of the doubt? Why is it so hard? And my second question is for Mr. McGovern. A couple days ago, I saw in the news that Hugo Chavez, when he was speaking at the UN, he came out saying that he had documentary evidence that the U.S. was planning to invade Venezuela in a plan called Operation Balboa. And I was just wondering if you had, when you were working with the CIA, if you had any sort of knowledge as to that information.
Well, let me... allude to the Iranian thing first. Your question had to do with why Iran needs nuclear fuel, I think. Or you're saying Iran has a desire to have a nuclear capability. And I would like to make a comment on that. Vice President Cheney is fond of saying, with all that oil... Yeah, with all that oil, Iran doesn't need a nuclear capability for energy. For Pete's sake, they don't. So it must be for weapons. Now, interestingly enough, under the Ford administration, okay, Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney advocated strongly to let the Shah of Iran have nuclear fuel capabilities, nuclear reactors for energy. Why? Because they bought the Shah's argument that he's going to run out of oil. Eventually, he's going to need nuclear energy, okay? So the duplicity of this crowd, by their own record, can be shown that at one point they said, yeah, of course they need it for energy, and now they're saying not. The second one had to do with Can't read my writing here. Operation. Oh, Venezuela. Well, there are always war plans. As a matter of fact, I have a quotation in my office, a quotation from Donald Rumsfeld. There will always be war plans, God willing. How about that? So, you know, there are contingency plans for everything, and I'm sure there's one to take over Venezuela, but I think that's one reason we have to get out on the streets, folks, because it may sound bizarre to us, but there are plans to do it. And, you know, if, as Michael suggests, there's no facing up to reality with respect to energy needs, there's no sensible way of converting all that hot air from Texas into renewable energy, then those kinds of things are not to be ruled out. Why? Well, because the crazies are in control still.
Okay, thank you very much. We've come to the conclusion of this session. We have sessions all week. And I'd like to thank our panelists today. A great presentation for a very fine audience. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Citizens Tribunal on Iraq. The panel you just heard took place on September 19th in Binghamton, New York, as part of the events surrounding the federal conspiracy trial of the Ithaca peace activists, the St. Patrick's Four. Meanwhile, there is a less fashionable war. That is the title of an article by Charles Shaw, published on September 29th in Dissident Voice. Shaw wrote, "Malcolm X once said, any person who claims to have deep feeling for other human beings should think a long, long time before he votes to have other men kept behind bars, caged. I am not saying there shouldn't be prisons, but there shouldn't be bars. Behind bars, a man never reforms." On Friday, September 9th, I became one of roughly 25,000 people released from an Illinois prison this year, 600,000 nationally, after completing only 10 weeks of a one-year sentence due to extreme overcrowding. My crime was victimless. Simple possession of a controlled substance, specifically a small amount of marijuana and MDMA. But as the rare upper-middle-class educated white American in prison, I found myself in a truly alien, self-perpetuating world of crushing poverty and ignorance, violent dehumanization, institutionalized racism, and an entire subculture of recidivists, some of whom had done 9 or 10 stints, many dating back to the 70s. Most used prison as a form of criminal networking, knowing full well they would be left to fend for themselves when released. We were told on many occasions that an inmate was worth more inside prison than back in society. Considering it costs an average of $37,000 a year to incarcerate offenders, and the average income for black Americans is $24,000, and only $8,000 to $12,000 for poor blacks, one can easily see their point. But unlike the vast majority of ex-offenders, I was fortunate enough to return to an established life and work and a support system of friends, family, and colleagues. The Chicago Tribune reported this year that about two-thirds of the more than 600,000 ex-convicts released in 2005 will be rearrested within 3 years, and about half will return to prison for a new crime or violation of parole. Despite having, quote, paid their debt to society, once released, their punishment is not nearly over. These days, there is little to no hope of any real reform, as within the various departments of corrections, correction is a painfully misleading euphemism for the warehousing of offenders. There are few, if any, re-entry programs for ex-offenders, and virtually no jobs or social services to help them keep afloat in an increasingly difficult and unforgiving society. Thus, most ex-offenders have no choice but to return to their old crime-infested neighborhoods, destitute and desperate to survive any way they can. A significant majority of the new crimes or parole violations are drug-related, often nothing more than testing positive on a monthly drug screen. The lack of any employment, training, or rehabilitative opportunities has created a permanent underclass of ex-offenders who remain trapped in poverty, unable to provide for themselves or their families without resorting to the few generally illegal means available to them. Faced with their very survival, most have no compunction about engaging or re-engaging, as the case may be, in drug dealing rather than starving. What may be even worse is that for some, their ongoing, quote, crimes are only those of association or, in some cases, the consequences of being black and poor. Laws prohibiting ex-felons from associating with other ex-felons and gang members, such as the Illinois Street Gang Terrorism Omnibus Prevention Act, or those preventing ex-offenders from being in areas designated as, quote, high crime or where, quote, controlled substances are illegally sold, used, distributed, or administered, means that many ex-offenders are in violation of their parole simply by going home, where the majority in their neighborhood, including family members, have criminal records and drugs are sold on almost every corner. I cannot begin to recount all the men I met, particularly those with prior records or those on parole, who were reincarcerated for crimes they did not commit, simply because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people. Gasps, not possible. Lies, propaganda, our system is just. True, it is, for those who can afford justice in the form of a bond and a private lawyer, or for those for whom the system is not unduly prejudiced. But in a system with corrupt cops eager for arrests, zealous state attorneys eager for convictions, jaded and overwhelmed public defenders eager for quick pleas, and rigid bond judges eager to set bail far beyond what anyone in their socioeconomic class could reasonably afford, there is little opportunity for a fair trial. For so many, including myself, the conditions in the penitentiary were preferable to those in Cook County Jail, where some 30,000 detainees languish awaiting the resolution of their cases. So a quick plea is the lesser of all evils and the shortest route to freedom. Had I chose to fight my case, there is little doubt I would be still in there today. In the end, what does that say about our criminal justice system? Instead of correction and rehabilitation, what we have is what University of Nevada, Las Vegas criminal justice professor Richard Sheldon calls a criminal justice industrial complex, where the police, the courts, and the prison system have become huge self-serving and self-perpetuating bureaucracies, which, along with corporations, have a vested interest in keeping crime at a certain level. They need victims and they need criminals, even if they have to invent them, as they have throughout the war on drugs and war on gangs. 30 years ago, Gore Vidal noted that roughly 80% of police work in the United States has to do with the regulation of our private morals, controlling what we drink, eat, smoke, put into our veins, with whom and how we have sex or gamble. Then, there were roughly 250,000 prisoners in the nation. Today, there are more than 2 million, with another million in county jails awaiting trial or sentencing, and roughly another 3 million under, quote, correctional supervision, on probation or parole. The total national cost of incarceration was $4 billion annually. Today, it is $64 billion, with another $20 billion in federal money, and $22 to $24 billion in money from state governments earmarked for waging the so-called war on drugs. Yet, throughout all this time and expense, there has not been the slightest decrease in either drug use or supply. And amidst all the talk of race as a factor in the Katrina disaster, let us not forget a bigger disaster. One in every 20 black men over the age of 18 is in prison, compared to one in 180 white men. Despite African Americans comprising only 12% of the total population, in 5 states, including Illinois, the ratio of black to white prisoners is 13 to 1. The U.S. Department of Justice reports that blacks comprise 56.7% of all drug offenders admitted to state prisons, while whites comprise only 23.3%. In my Illinois prison, one of 28 in the state, of the 1,076 inmates, 689 were black, 251 were white, and 123 were Latino. Based upon these numbers, a full 30% of African Americans will see time in prison during their life, compared with only 5% of white Americans, even though white drug users outnumber blacks by a 5-to-1 margin. Anyone familiar with these facts was not surprised by the response to the largely poor and black victims of Katrina. It was simply a further affirmation of their invisible status within our society, further proof of the third world existing within the first in America. What may be the biggest shame of all is how New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin himself reinforced all the most miserable black stereotypes by characterizing the looters as, quote, drug-starved, crazy addicts wreaking havoc, close quote, in an attempt to expedite federal assistance and to justify a declaration of martial law. It spoke volumes to what resonates within the public consciousness, stirring up some of our deepest fears. It's time to realize once and for all that this war is lost. It's akin to trying to empty the flooded New Orleans streets one teaspoon at a time. But sadly, Americans have forgotten this war amongst the multitude of more fashionable, media-friendly others that have arisen in the last 5 years. As peace groups mobilize for a national march on Washington later this month to end the Iraq War, a few miles away from the mall, the drug war is still raging. The Sentencing Project and the Schaffer Library for Drug Policy reported that at one point in the 1990s, half of all black men 18 to 35 in Washington, D.C. were either in jail or on probation or on parole, and more than 90% had arrest records. No matter how much the government pours into the war on drugs, it doesn't appear to make a dent in drug use or drug-related crime. The body count in this war still rises. Dead and corrupted cops, dead gang youth, dead traffickers and couriers, dead innocent bystanders, the urban collateral damage, devastated families, addiction disease, overdoses from unregulated poor quality drugs, exploding prisons, crushing costs, corrupt officials, craven politicians, sensationalist media, and a limitless harvest of offenders. Where does the madness end? We cannot address poverty and race in America, nor can we talk about needless death and expense without addressing the drug war. If we don't stop the direction in which we are heading, by 2020 there will be over 6 million people in prison and thousands more lives extinguished in the crossfire of a domestic war that we had no chance of winning in the first place. And that was A Less Fashionable War by Charles Shaw. Shaw is a writer and activist and the publisher and editor-in-chief of Newtopia. Thanks to Chris McConkie, Bill Houston, Stefan Schweitzer, and Binghamton IMC for their assistance with tonight's program. To download an MP3 copy of this or previous programs, visit our website at www.unwelcomeguests.com. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by a